It's messing with our minds, disturbing our sleep, and causing depression and anxiety. In many ways, it's a necessary evil that we can't go a few hours without. But what is it doing to us? Today, we learn more about social media and mental health. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More. In this episode, we learn about social media and its relationship to our mental health. Now, there have been several studies that have linked heavy social media usage to depression, anxiety, and even suicidal thoughts. On the flip side of that, some people say that social media is an escape, a mental health break, to look at what's going on with friends, look at photos. Well, okay, then we had the pandemic, and the social media became both a source of misinformation and a vital lifeline to friends and family. It seems like it's a giant social experiment, and that's probably because it is. To learn more, I'm joined by Ricky Thompson. She is an associate professor of digital rhetoric and writing studies at the University of Washington. You may recognize her from the first season of Learning More, where she joined us to talk about online and pandemic dating. Ricky, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you again.
I've got to tell you, you are one of the most prepared podcast guests ever, because you're the only one that has actually done research specific for this podcast. That is so awesome. So you did some research with your class about social media and mental health. Tell us what you found in that research.
Well, it was kind of funny when you reached out to me. I said, like, well, turns out we have a lesson planned right around week five.
Perfect.
we're going to be looking at social media and mental mm-hmm. health. And so when I was able to use it as an opportunity to teach students how to look at that research area themselves, mm-hmm. How to collect some data, how to set up survey questions. And I just did also a small survey, which I've been doing this in different sections of this class over the years. So the data mm-hmm. just keeps kind of piling up in different ways. And some of the things that I found probably not too surprising to a lot of people were that FOMO is one of those areas that people are constantly focused on when it comes to mental health and social media.
The fear of missing out on things.
Yeah. Yeah. And the anxiety that people feel when they see all their friends and their family posting all these great pictures of mm-hmm. vacations and great times. And they're like, oh, you know, my life is not that as great as theirs. And so that continually shows up. And a lot of trends that keep kind of, I'd say, accelerating a little, or each year I see more and more people talking about kind of the concerns with women and women's perceptions of feeling self-conscious or not feeling good enough because they're comparing themselves to others by looking at the social media posts of friends and also influencers. I think with the rise of influencers, like on Instagram, for example, that's definitely become much more noticeable in that people are following very curated profiles that are often unrealistic expectations of beauty. And though we may say this is not much different than when we used to talk about
Cosmo magazine back in the 90s or Victoria's Secret or whatever it was, the different things that would come in, just a different medium now.
Yeah. All the models, the swimsuit models, you know, in the 90s, that, you know, that was a big focus around media studies mm-hmm. and gendered representations and what that was doing to affect mental health of young girls who felt they needed to be a size zero and, you know, stop eating. And so I think we're seeing the same type of concern and the same kind of issue surfacing around, you know, the digitally mediated form where people are advertising themselves and really, and with the technology to filter your photos in ways, I mean, you know, with mass communication mm-hmm. and we think about the models in the 90s, those were professionals, you know, and not everybody had that kind of technology, but now, you know, everyone can filter their own photos on their phone in 2 seconds. So,
Or even on Zoom, like you're doing a live chat with somebody and you can filter. I filter out all the wrinkles,
I did do the filter to test it out, and I realized it just didn't look quite right. I was like,
it's basically making your face look blurry.
And I thought, maybe I want my boss to see how exhausted I look, so they stop asking me to do more work. But anyway.
Well, now there's a Zoom filter idea. Have it at the start of the meeting. You look fine. By the end of the meeting, you look exhausted. Actually, I guess we don't need that. That happens anyway.
And I think the other thing that was showing up in the data that quite often shows up is kind of the issue of distraction. Social media is a distraction that has kind of a good side and a bad side. Good in that it gives you a mental break from other things, especially when that distraction may be doing something mindless, you know, like playing solitaire, you know, versus or what's the other one? Candy Crush, you know, it's on your phone app. I mean, doing that as a break from really intense cognitive work, and that can be seen as a good thing. But on a negative side is that then it becomes, you go down the rabbit hole of, you know, Facebook for hours or doom scrolling on Twitter. You're now distracted in a bad way because you're not getting your work done. And hours have passed. And for many people, they're still up at night, you know, with their phone next to them in bed.
Yep.
Right. So those are some of the kind of, you know, good and bad things that we're seeing. And,
you know, on that point, you know, a lot of people blame the social media for that or blame the technology for that. Right. Like I do that with YouTube, where it's just like I am endlessly like watching video after video after video because the next video just happens to show up right when I was like, oh, okay. So I could watch, you know, whatever, we'll just say cat videos, you know, whatever it is. I watched some, you know, MLB thing the other day. Next thing you know, I'm watching players that can't catch the ball in football or something. And then it went to soccer. It did all the sports and I just kept watching. Next thing I know, an hour and a half has gone by. We blame the technology for that, but should I really? I mean, I'm the one that didn't get out of the chair and stop watching it.
And this is a good question, right? I think there's a little bit of both going on. I think that yes, there's ways in which technology is being designed, but it's designed by people. It's not the technology in and of itself. A good example that you just gave, and I'm thinking about Netflix, for example. When Netflix first came out, after your show ended, there was a bit of a lag, just enough of a lag that you might have went, oh, the show's over, get up, stretch, maybe I'll go to bed. Now, it doesn't even give you a space. It, you know, pops up the new movie in the new screen while the old screen is showing the credits, so that the technology is now being designed in ways to keep you engaged, because the goal is to engage you. And the longer you're on the screen, you know, the longer you're watching, you know, the more revenue they're making or more advertising dollars they can sell. So there is this drive by developers to keep people engaged. There's a great documentary called The Social Dilemma, which I actually watched on Netflix.
Right?
I watched it on Netflix and I probably binged three shows right after it. This idea of binging, for example, right? Binging is, we used to talk about as a food issue, but the fact that we use it much more in relation to consumption of media is really telling. And part of that is because there's even no breaks. I mean, if you think about old network TV, you knew every like 10 minutes, there was going to be a 2 minute commercial break where you get up and run to the bathroom, you know, grab a drink. There's no breaks on Netflix, right? Like you really could sit there for hours and until it gives you the, are you still watching? Right. Like if you know that exists, that means you've watched it long enough to know.
Yeah.
You haven't taken a break. So there is that part where, and we talk about this in internet studies, or, you know, in technology studies as like technological determinism, that the technology determines what we're going to do. And that it's really it's the technology's fault, right? So to speak. Mm-hmm. But then there's the issue of individual agency and freedom of choice to do things. And while we can say, yes, people have to make choices and people can make choices, we also want to be really mindful that in order to make those choices, we have to be aware of the ways in which the technology is being designed to keep us sucked in, right? And the social mm-hmm. dilemma, that documentary, talks specifically about the many ways in which developers are continuing to find those little nooks to right. keep people engaged, like get mm-hmm. rid of commercial breaks, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think the biggest things that people need to be thinking about is continuing to find ways to be mindful and check in with self. And part of that is to force yourself to find ways to take breaks from social media that is not going to encourage that. And there's all these productivity apps that are including apps that are designed to give you a break, right? There's
right.
There's
the Pomodoro apps. Stuff. And
yeah. I'm like Pomodoro, right? Is a productivity app where mm-hmm. you're like, work for 25 minutes, 5 minute break, work for 25 minutes, 5 minute break. Like it's on. And so the timer dings, you're supposed to get up. Now, mind you, I sometimes continue to work when the timer told me to get up.
And it's like, shoot, my 5 minutes is up now too.
But even just like being mindful, right? Being mindful of yourself and going, oh my God, I can use the app, but I still have to like follow what I'm being asked to do. There's all these apps that are designed to keep us off our social media while we're at work so that we're not getting distracted. Those are clearly designed as a response because many of us don't have the self-control, I guess we could say. Right. But I would argue again, I think it's an interconnected problem of people and tech, and you know, technology doesn't create the problem. People created the problem, but once the technology allows a certain affordance, right, or allows you to do things in certain ways, or starts influencing you to do things in ways, especially in ways that drive your brain, right? So the idea
I mean, it's all gamified, right? The likes and subscribes and, you know, whatever it is, it's gamified to get you to want more, get those endorphins going. So it's like, gotta have more.
So if you have that going, you're kind of working against the system a little bit, right? So I think that,
thinking about, you brought up a, sorry, I was checking my Instagram. I wasn't paying attention there. You brought up the social dilemma, and I think you know the role of these big companies is really displayed in that movie, right? You've got these should we be having more like rules and responsibility placed via the government or whatever it is on these companies, because really, in many ways, we're a part of a giant experiment. Mm-hmm. You know, like social media, it's fairly new to everyone, right? And it's gained traction over the years, but it is a fairly new thing that we're all trying to figure out what's next with this. And we don't know any of the long-term risks. We don't know if in 15 years, 50 years, 100 years, what this is going to do to society and to our mental health. The only thing that we know now is there's higher incidence of like anxiety disorders, depression, things like that. We're seeing that, and it is linked in some cases to people that are using social media more. What do you feel like? I mean, first of all, it's hard to walk away from social media altogether. But when you see somebody like, your child or, spouse or somebody that you're with that is showing signs, I guess we'll say, of addiction to social media, and they're seeing some of the depression and anxiety and things that come along with it, what do we do?
Well, I think it's so interesting that the framework of addiction has really become kind of one of the big labels, and that that started coming up in about the last 10 years, which is right around the time that the swipey apps and the smartphones really, I mean, those were about 2007, 2008. So that's also when we started really seeing our devices creating a much more kind of gamified experience for people, and people creating a lot more apps that I think many have argued are addictive, right? So there's something about having this mobile device that fits in the palm of your hand versus when you had to actually go sit at your computer, right? Mm-hmm. That allows us to feel this sense of, oh, I can do it at any time, you know?
Right.
So now there's a lot of studies that still question whether or not is addiction even the right frame, you know, to use to talk about mm-hmm. this. But I think what is beneficial for us in using that frame is that we are asking the question of how is this good for us? And if it's in fact, if there's like a compulsion or some form of kind of uncontrollable urge and use of technology that gets people in a place that they no longer have, what would we say, healthy, productive relationships and are they holding a job? All these things, right? Like right. when is it really addictive? And the reason I say this is because the word addiction just gets bandied around a lot. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I'm so addicted to my phone. But if we really look at like diagnostics statistics manual about what makes something addictive, that's pretty extreme. But there are people that they're saying, yeah, they're in that place. I think what we're really talking about for the average person is it's still this sense of overuse or use right. in a way that is either causing you to be disengaged from other people, like you're at the table with your family and you can't put your phone down, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're not getting your work done. Like, so I think when we start thinking about, all right, what I'm really saying here is this is an issue for a lot of people. And if you see it with people in your life, my first thing would be to say, talk to them, right? Yeah. Now that's a hard one, right? If somebody is really addicted, right? If they really, mm-hmm. They don't think there's anything wrong with their behavior, then, you know, you may come into resistance and you may not be very helpful. But I think the question I would ask myself and that before I kind of addressed it with someone else would be, what am I not getting in this relationship with this person or what concerns do I have for this person? And I would come to them with the concerns, right? I'm worried. It looks like you haven't been getting your work done. And I notice you're on your phone a lot. Can we talk about it? Right. Mm-hmm. Or I notice you've been really depressed lately and I haven't, for more people, we know our friends are depressed when they stop posting on social media. Mm-hmm. That's more often when I've heard people talk about it is, which means they have nothing happy to share, right? So they're not right. posting. So I think what I think is more useful to us is be aware if you see people in your world whose behavior is changing. Are they disengaging in some way from you? Are they on social media less than they used to be? Does that mean it's time to pick up the phone and give them a call, right?
Gotcha. So you're kind of more looking for the change. Like, is there a change? Yeah. In behavior then.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you said there is, you know, they might be more depressed when they stop posting. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that to me is, you know, when we're looking at somebody's social media posts and, you know, I kind of threw in anxiety and depression in that, you know, last question, but we didn't really, mm-hmm. I threw that away. We got to get back into that. But before we do, and I'm kind of leading us there a little bit with this one, is we're looking at highlight reels for people, right? We're looking at, you know, the trailer of their, you know, best of moments when we're watching, you know, their clips on social media, looking at their clips on social media. I sort of think of, well, that's also kind of like, you know, like a comedian. A comedian's on stage. They're standing there. We're hearing their little bits. You know, they're unfiltered. They're funny. They're hilarious. And then they walk back and they're by themselves and they're on the road 90% of the year. And, you know, they can't make friends because they're moving from place to place. Mm-hmm. Their life could be seen as pretty depressing. And many comedians have described that, but they're so funny on stage. It's sort of what we're seeing in social media, but potentially with some people, right? Where we're seeing the highlight reels. Now, there's those people that are posting that, but then now I'm tying in that anxiety and you know, like the depression and the different, you know, disorders that could potentially come along because of this. We're seeing those highlight reels and we're comparing those highlight reels when we know the reality behind it is for us, We don't have those highlight reels. We see everything. We're seeing the whole movie, and the rest of the movie might not be as great as the highlight reel.
For sure. Yeah. Even though I say, well, you watch for when people aren't posting as much, that's an indicator. I bring that one up because people don't think about that one as much, yeah. But I do think the other one that we are very aware of that's going on, in research about this is the fact that that being exposed to the constant highlight reel and the curated perfect life of other people in your world can be really, anxiety producing for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They're feeling like they can't keep up. They don't have quite the good life. And then there's also the people who are truly unhappy inside. Your example of the comedians, I'm thinking of Robin Williams when you said that, right?
Right.
Somebody who on the surface looks so happy. And there's no question. I definitely know some people who, if you look at their social media feed, they are living the life. And, mm-hmm. An evening just sitting down and chatting with them, you actually learn that they're very unhappy and that the only place they're connecting is through the social media feeds that they're putting out mm-hmm. into the world. And some of them, we'll talk about it as an aspirational way to pick themselves up, right? To get likes so that they mm-hmm. feel a sense of goodness about themselves, right? That people are following them. And that is definitely one of the issues. And I think your point you made earlier is right on that. Yes, this is a social experiment. We don't know long-term, and the technology keeps changing so quickly as well. So our ability to figure out, what's going on and kind of change, the minute we figure it out, now the technology is different. Like, Facebook was evil. And then, now we have swipey apps. Maybe those are more evil, mm-hmm. I think even trying to figure out how to keep up with this, becomes quite a challenge. But the other thing is, how do you know who these people are that are, struggling with anxiety and depression if they are, in fact, presenting a highlight reel all the time that gives the impression they're okay? Because the other part of this is, for people who post this very happy life, even though it might not be, many people will think they're okay. So people aren't going to reach out to them out of concern because they think they're okay. Or they feel they're in competition and they can't keep up with that. Like, mm-hmm. So-and-so does this crazy stuff and I can't keep up with that. So maybe I shouldn't connect. When in fact, that person might be looking for somebody to go do stuff with and maybe willing to meet people halfway. So I think one of the other things that social media can be really problematic about, and this is also part of that earlier point about kind of people versus the tools, is that many of the ways in which social media apps work now are designed around not just a highlight reel, but a soundbite, if we could use those metaphors together. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we're not following lengthy blogs for people like we were in the early part of the millennia. Like blogs were the big thing that people were reading, right? Or they were in mm-hmm. discussion boards where people wrote a lot. They sat on their computer. You had a big screen. And so the reading practices of how much you could see and consume was quite different than once it turned to the mobile phone. And so this kind of attention span, you can also connect it to kind of reading habits and kind of that visual, the visual space.
Right.
And also people's practices. Like, people are much faster typing on a keyboard than they are with their fingers. There are some pretty fast typers with their fingers, but, and depending on what size the phones are this year, they're small, they're big, they're small, they're big. and also as you get older and your eyesight starts going and you need to have a bigger screen, mm-hmm. increase the size. By the way, I now have a bigger screen. I'm starting to need reading glasses. I'm like, I get it. The phones are not designed for users who have hand mobility issues or vision issues. So then you also have certain groups that are using those devices in certain mm-hmm. ways. And I feel like I've started going down my own rabbit hole here, but to bring this back, there's this kind of connection between the tools and what the tools let you do and how the tools let you interact. But then there is also how people are actually using them. So if people are, if the platforms are getting designed so that you really only can put a picture and a small amount of text, then you start, as a user, you start just putting a small amount of text.
Right. If
a good example is dating apps, right? So mm-hmm. We think about, you know, the older desktop versions where you could write a really lengthy profile and write a novella about yourself, and then, you know, switch to swipey apps and Tinder and Bumble and all those. And you don't, even the space that you have in your profile is very limited. And this is the same thing if you think about how a lot of social media apps work. Think about Snapchat. You really can only write a very small amount and it's going to disappear. So you really have to write a small amount because it has to be short enough that the people can read it,
right,
before it disappears, right? Whether it's
right.
7 seconds,
yeah,
10 seconds, whatever the setting is. So part of this is fueled by the attention span changing, but the attention span changing is also part of us creating tools that are,
it's a chicken and egg.
It is. And so I guess, yeah. So again, I don't want to blame them all. I want to say, well, we created these tools, but we created these tools because we see that people like them when they do this, or if they don't like it, they'll use the other app. They'll stay on the desktop app if it really matters to them that there's more to read about somebody in a dating profile, which I found in my research that some people prefer certain apps that allow more space to have a profile that has things written, and others like it to just be about pictures. And so they're good with a quick highlight reel / soundbite. And so we're kind of in a space now where if we start thinking about a lot of different social media platforms and the way they operate, they're almost adding and kind of accelerating the highlight reel soundbite kind of way of being in the world. I mean, even Instagram, if you start typing, you can only see like the first line of what you've written in your post.
Right.
You can't, even though you can write a lot, you have to open it. And if somebody has to do an extra tap, and you start realizing that. So as a user, you're like, oh, just a quick hashtag, right? Like,
right. Why would I write more? Nobody's going to see it.
Yeah. And so part of that is design, you know, and part of that is users adapting to design or changing the way they use the apps, or sometimes just hacking the apps to make the apps work differently. There's lots of apps that operate in certain ways now because users use them differently and they went, oh, this actually works better, or people like it and it makes money. So let's do it.
Right. Well, yeah, the amount of analytics that they're looking at, and the amount of data, like usage data, you can see some of the stuff where, oh, the person put their finger on this spot and held it for this amount of time, and then they scrolled this distance. And I mean, it's insane the amount of data that they're storing and looking at and analyzing. I'm thinking about that
when I'm reading an article. Yeah, when I'm reading an article on my phone, I'm like, don't stop too far long on that ad because I know they're tracking my
eye. Exactly. You
know,
you're going to get that ad again.
It creates anxiety. For me as a user, I find myself on definitely, for sure. And I, you know, talk about anxiety. Many people are very anxious about how much they're being tracked and how much their experience in different social media platforms is being decided for them, you know, often against what they think they're trying to do. You know, the idea that what you're seeing on Facebook is just what naturally occurs, you know, we know from the algorithms, I saw an article in Wired just a week or two ago about how you can change the setting. If you don't know this, you can change the setting to have all the posts come up chronologically. So you really do see who's just posted most recently, not who Facebook has decided you
comment, what you should see. Right. Yeah.
And that now you have to see everything about this person's life all the time and you can't get rid of them. And you can't see anybody else, right? You can't see your other friends who you miss.
Right. the anxiety thing. You know, like I think of this one night I posted something and it was for, you know, like the podcast Twitter account that I had. Right. Mm-hmm. And I posted something and I was like, eh, that's kind of funny. And then I went to bed and 15, 20 minutes later, I was like, well, wait a minute, you know, did I say this or should I have said it this way? And then I get up, I come back into the office, I changed it. And then I, you know, and it was like queued up to post the next morning or whatever. So then I go lay down. 3 hours later, I'm back in the office again, editing this. And I'm like, this is one tweet. Why am I doing this? Like, what's, you know, but like, there is that anxiety around this of almost having to produce, like, okay, it's got to be, you know, the grammar's got to be good. The word's got to be, you can't offend anybody. Just, you know, like, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do that. Like, there's a lot that has to go into each post now. So even posting can make a person pretty anxious.
No question. And I will tell you, I felt the same one, although I haven't gone to bed and ruminated and then got up and changed it. I just sat there for way too long on a tweet that's, you know, half a sentence long where I'm like, is this what I want to say? Is this what I want to say? Do I want to tag this particular, you know, group? And all the things you've said, right? Like, don't offend anybody. I think the fear of being canceled has added to a lot of anxiety, especially people who are in the public eye in any way. If your work, you know, is, I think if you're, well, not just, I shouldn't say especially, I mean, if I was a teenager, I would be completely fearful. I mean, the bullying in, you know, school environments and in your social world is also very, can be very, very upsetting. And at that age when our hormones are, you know, in crazy mode, and everything feels even more exaggerated. But I think from a professional standpoint too, right? You're talking about podcast. I'm thinking about, I'm sharing, you know, a research article that I just did, you know, or a talk I did. I'm like, do I say queer or not? Like, if I'm queer, then it's okay, but they might not be okay with queer if they're an older user, right? Like, so even like the right word and the fact that we go back and edit and right with Twitter, a little harder. Twitter doesn't let you edit. You just got to delete it, right? Right. There's, you're really committed. Mm-hmm. You're like, don't send until it's right. Yeah. And when I think about the fact that, I mean, what you're saying is you have one, you also have the push to be promoting your business and promoting yourself and branding yourself on social media. I mean, I'm a professor, I'm a scholar, I'm a teacher. One of the questions in the book proposal I was putting together recently that the publisher was asking me was, how many followers do I have on social media and could I help promote this book? And this is part of what they want to know before they want to take
it. Before you can even sign. Yeah.
Right. Wow. So now I'm thinking as somebody who's a mid-career scholar, I'm not hugely famous all over the world, what I would call the rock, one of the rock stars. So I'm still building my presence and my brand and, you know, trying to get my stuff visible. And now I've been told by a book publisher that this is probably important that I am self-promoting. And, you know, you're trying to get followers because once you get followers, maybe you also can get some support other ways, right? And then followers breed more followers because people tell their friends and they tell their friends and so on, right? And the whole commercial went. So now there's all this anxiety about doing it right. And, you know, I think in the old analog world, it would be out there and we knew it, but the chances of it, I mean, unless you were really afraid something was going to end up in a newspaper. But now it's so easy for our posts to go viral and to destroy lives and get somebody canceled pretty fast. And, and that's not good. That creates huge amount of anxiety. It's added anxiety to people professionally, right? Mm-hmm. In ways that we never had to think about.
Right.
Teaching a class, there was a TV show called The Chair that was out this year on Netflix, right? About academics. And there's Sandra Oh is the chair of the English department. And as somebody who's done some administration, I felt a lot of what was happening in this show. But one of the professors is, you know, leading a lecture and students take a video of him. He's being sarcastic about Hitler, and he does, you know, the Heil Hitler sign in this sarcastic way. And next thing you know, it's like remixed, and you know, he's a Nazi, and Nazis, the university mm-hmm. is like, he must make an apology and he's going to lose his job. You know, all these things that come up with, like, students have phones, you know, everywhere. Employees have phones. Everybody's carrying a phone with them everywhere. They're recording everything.
Yeah.
And you mm-hmm. don't know if you're going to get recorded.
Right.
You know, being the person who is angry at the coffee shop, and you become the next.
Yeah. The guy yelling at clouds or whatever. Yeah. You know, you got to watch yourself in so many different ways. I do this other podcast called This Is Today. It's a daily podcast. And yes, that is a cheap plug so that I can get more followers. It's basically me talking about the historical events and whatever national day it is, but there's a lot of commentary in there and some jokes sprinkled in. And as with any content creator, it's like, now I have this real fear that something that I say will cause me to be canceled. No matter how innocent I perceive that something, or one person might perceive it, another person might see it differently, and it's spun into a meme or a media soundbite. It's a big change for content creators, and definitely adds anxiety when producing content. In the old days of content creation, you would just need to basically not upset the advertisers. You know, speaking of advertisers, I do want to keep them happy as well. Let's take a short break. We're going to continue the conversation with Ricky right after this. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. Click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More. I'm Russ. And I'm talking with Ricky Thompson. She's Associate Professor of Digital Rhetoric and Writing Studies at the University of Washington. Before the break, we were talking about the added stressors involved with creating content. When talking stress and anxiety, we have to bring up the pandemic, and specifically the lockdowns. Social media played a different role, and the new tools were adopted quickly, like Zoom, which in many ways became a sort of social media for us. Prior to the pandemic, I think many of us looked at social media as a distraction. And I feel like the pandemic changed the way that we are looking at social media. What do you think?
Well, I think one of the first things that we noticed about social media during the pandemic was it was a lifeline that we didn't realize was so important to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think about how quickly people were finding ways to connect the minute they were in lockdowns, right? Where people were having their Zoom happy hours, they were, joining the yoga class. I was going to this dance party every Wednesday at 5 o'clock for a couple months.
Nice.
with friends who I knew were on it at the same time. So it was like social,
mm-hmm.
And so I think on the one hand, people went, oh, well, we have all these tools. And on the other hand, people went, wow, hey, have you ever heard of Zoom? And people who've been using Zoom and Skype forever were like, yeah. But what we also had happen was the realization that a lot of us didn't have the bandwidth or the real infrastructure. And there are people who were left out, right? People who didn't have, even just having enough Wi-Fi connectivity in your house, you now had families all at home, multiple people in the same house.
Trying to all connect at the same time to different things.
Yeah.
And
the mm-hmm. amount of people who had to like up their Wi-Fi, and some people can't afford that, right? So you also had kind of the you had the haves and have nots, and you started seeing how that became an issue. I think about how I have students who don't actually have a camera on their computer because their computer's not that fancy, right? So then you start having kind of that have and have nots.
Yeah. Or they don't want to turn on the camera because the background is not good or, you know, whatever.
I do know of somebody who was teaching a class and the student's dad was walking around in their underwear behind the student. and the student didn't even know it because it's behind them. And everybody in the class on Zoom was like, oh, so there's all these. So talk about anxiety, right?
Right.
The social pressures of, I think what we, at first, what became this savior, you know, technology as the savior, which often is the case. I mean, if you look historically, whenever there's a new technology, there's this huge group, the technophiles who are like, it's going to save us. It's going to be the new thing that is going to, you know, bring us closer. People felt this way about the telephone. People felt this way about, you know, the radio, but you also had the technophiles, the people who were like, this is going to ruin society.
Exactly.
People will never see each other in person ever again. They're just going to be on their phones. And well, now they're on their phones, but a different kind.
Right. You know, I'm glad we're touching on this because Zoom introduced an interesting dynamic for meetings. When you're in the conference room or you're in the classroom, you can tell when a person's looking at you. When you're on Zoom, you have no idea. So really, you have to pay attention to your reactions. Also, you can look at yourself. So you're just more aware of what you're doing. And that like just constant self-monitoring, I feel like it just takes a toll and contributes to that Zoom exhaustion that we feel.
Well, it's a different kind of cognitive work. It's different cognitive work to just be looking at each other and talking and trying to, you know, follow what you're saying and kind of see what you're saying. But when I'm also watching how I'm performing, then I'm also monitoring in a way. Mm-hmm. And that monitoring, which they've done some studies about it since the pandemic, that women do this far more than men and find themselves far more exhausted because of this, because of the cognitive load of monitoring their appearance, and which is not good, right? Like the fact that you feel a different kind of exhaustion, you got rid of the commute, but now, you know, my other complaint is just sitting in the same chair. It's not the best chair anymore.
Yeah, there is that too. Yeah. Much better chairs in the conference rooms.
yeah. But that anxiety, right? Of also being kind of forced to look at the screen. So there's been lots of discussion. Teachers were really discussing this at the beginning of the pandemic about whether their students should be forced to have their screens on so that the teacher could see everybody so they could see kids weren't screwing around. Right.
Right. Make sure they're actually there.
Yeah. But I think also from that, I don't know if egotistical is the right word, but from that feeling of when you're the speaker that you like to look out and see the audience is, you want to see that they're engaged, and you can see that when you're looking at students or if you're doing a performance, you can see if people are sleeping or doing other things. Mm-hmm. And so if everybody's Zoom screen is black, it's like you're talking into the void and you don't know if people are paying attention and they're muted. So you don't hear it. You also don't hear it. And I think that also then adds anxiety to the person who is performing or, you know, teaching or instructing. But at the same time, we also need to be thinking about the anxiety of the people who are on the other screen who, you know, don't have a good enough computer, don't have good enough Wi-Fi, who are actually bandwidth issues or live with their parents and, you know, their
dad's walking around in his underwear.
Walking around in his underwear. And I think there's a little bit of I think people need to kind of be understanding and find ways to give people space to interact. I've definitely found like when I do small groups, most students will put on their camera. But I invite them and I ask them in the beginning, like, hey, what's your camera status? Like, would you like to turn it on? Do you not have a camera? You know, is there, you know, mm-hmm. and they'll, And then they'll say, and I'm like, or you could turn it on when it's your turn, you know, so we could, we'd love to see you, but you know, I totally get it if, you know, and I right. usually make some kind of joke, like, you know, if it's, your room is gross, I totally understand if you don't want to show us or you're still in your pajamas. And I think by making it lighthearted and kind of giving people permission, so we're not shaming them, because I think right. the other thing is there's a lot of shaming about people's behavior, about how they should be acting on their social media, you know, while they're totally. as in the new experiment, right? Like, okay, now mm-hmm. this is the new norm. So now we have to, people need to do this, you know, they need right. to do it this way.
Yeah. And that's another factor with social media. People are being shamed for something they did long ago. At that time it was first posted, mm-hmm. it was either ignored or applauded. And now it's a problem?
Well, I think you just pointed out the part of, it's not just the highlight reel, it's the fact that it's archived, right?
Yep. And mm-hmm. it never goes away.
Which we can see how Snapchat became really quite popular, because for the first time you weren't archiving everything you were sharing. There's a lot less stress on, you know, on an app where what you write is going to disappear. Of course, somebody could screenshot it and save it, which we know there was people had worries about that. But in general, you know, the practice of sending snaps is about no longer being tied to this kind of archiving digital mm-hmm. footprint that you have forever. And similarly, the stories, right? Instagram right. stories, Facebook stories, right? So this, we see this move, and there's definitely some trends, right? Younger users use the stories functions more, and older users use static posts. And and that in itself also says something about kind of the spontaneity versus the archivalness. And in some ways, or in many ways, a lot of younger users are just much more aware of that digital footprint. There's this concept of sharenting. Have you heard of this?
No. What is that?
Oh yeah. There's actually a pretty funny clip. You can look it up from the Daily Show. It was Lewis Black. There's a lot of profanity, so be warned. But he's like the grouchy person who's like, what's wrong with these parents out there? And sharenting is when parents are sharing their kids' stuff on social media. So you earlier asked about parents' worries about what do I do when my, you know, my kids are online all the time and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, a lot of the data shows that parents are just as bad, if not worse, about their social media use. Yet they focus on kids as the kids are the problem. They just use, I mean, how people use media may be a little different based on their age group and, you know, are they working or just socializing? But with all that said, parents posting pictures of their kids, like from the time they're a baby. And one of the things that I think parents don't always think about or don't know about is you don't have to put very much stuff out there on social media posts for somebody to take the identity of your child and create accounts because you posted their birth date, their full name, the city you're in. And the next thing you know, so-and-so has started a credit card with your child's name. And you're not going to, your kid's not going to find out about it till they're 18 and they, you know, apply, you know, for their first, you know, loan or whatever, or credit card that somebody has basically kind of become them for 18 years. And that's about parents oversharing and not asking. They often don't ask their kids' consent. You know, I think the fact, I think this reminds me, talk about anxiety as well, is there's this anxiety of not just what you are posting on your, you know, on your Twitter feed and whatever, but what other people are posting that they've tagged you in. And I mean, do you set up your own social media account so that you review what gets posted on your walls or your accounts before others see it? Or can I post something like, Russ, I'm going to tag you in my post, and you've got it set up so that it won't go to your wall, but it goes to my wall anyways. So
yeah. And if we know the same people, then it's out there.
Yeah. So, and I might not want that out there. And now I have anxiety. I was thinking about this very recently about a post that, that somebody had posted where at the time I thought, it was just a regular picture kind of, the picture itself wasn't completely problematic in the context. But then I started, like you, all night, started worrying about it later. Like, I wonder if somebody would interpret this image out of context in this way. Right. And I only thought about it because I did an interview that week with somebody about online dating, and they made a comment about certain kinds of photos. It was photos. It was like photos with animals, and they went crazy about all types of photos with animals in any way, shape, or form. And I was like, oh, could this be thought of as one of the, you know, like I was immediately worried and anxious.
Right.
And that's concerning, right? Like I can't take that picture down unless I tell that person, hey, will you take that down? And of course, then I may have to talk about more anxiety. I may have to deal with them teasing me or shaming me, you know, for whatever reason about how I, you know, what's my problem.
Yeah, Ricky wanted me to take this photo down. Do you guys see why?
Oh my God. Yes. And then let's have an entire Facebook conversation about
it. Oh man.
And ask everybody's opinion, which you've seen those on.
Oh social. Yeah.
You know, let's crowdsource what just happened here. And, so I think the other thing, right, is how what you're talking about is I think, sure, we talk less about depression and far more about anxiety. But, you know, often these are connected and, you know, you start getting anxious enough. And at some point you may decide you're also checking out. And and many people check out because they just feel, you know, the sadness of it. Right. Or they feel like this isn't connecting anymore. This is disconnecting, or this is, you know, these are not the way I want my relationships to, these aren't the relationships I want to be having in this way. They may not feel genuine because you're not really having true engaged conversation. You know, you're posting in some kind of group forum of some sort and people who know you may comment and have a conversation, but then there's also people you didn't know or, you know, friends of friends start posting.
Yeah.
Which happened to me. I posted an article about political perceptions around universities, and there was a shift. It was like a Pew Internet research poll, it's a number of years ago, and it had shown that there was now a majority of Republican voters that felt that universities, colleges, and universities were bad for the country. And as a college professor, you could see I was like, huh, interesting. And I just forwarded it. I didn't put any context. I was just like, huh, interesting new study. And all these people on my wall, like got on my wall, people who didn't know each other, you know, family members, friends, they just got into a cat fight, like from both sides. And I was like, oh. And also then, and I was implicated because I sent it and people had a lot of assumptions on both sides, depending on who they thought I was, about what I believed about it, because I didn't add any context about why I thought about it. I ended up doing a talk, and I have actually on my website, there's some links to what happened. I ended up doing some talks on it, and I wrote an op-ed and did a radio interview on KVI radio about kind of what are we doing in universities, and are we all liberals trying to turn young minds you know, one way, which my opinion is, no, that's not really what's happening. Sure, there are people that are always trying to, you know, there are going to be people in every degree area, but different parts of the country, different disciplinary fields, there tend to be different kind of statistics about political leanings of, you know, who teaches classes, and also what the curriculum is and what they're teaching. I mean, I think depending on your topic, you know, some topics are going to lead you down that road where some instructors are going to be very, their political position may be more visible than others. And some are very conscious of not making it known where they sit on the line. So I don't think it's a simple answer, but to go back to the original point was, this was just a post I put on social media, and it was probably the one thing that made me it made me think twice about what do I want to use my social media spaces for? And do I want to talk about politics at all? Do I want to talk about, I mean, I didn't think I was really talking about politics. I thought I was really just talking about the job I'm in, my job world, but it was clearly a political thing, but I didn't, that wasn't where I was going necessarily, but it became a politicized, right? So
yeah.
Well, I think, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, you don't know how people are going to take it, even though you meant it one way, they might take it a different way.
Right.
And yeah, it's like, how do you control all this? So it's like, you can stress about it before you post, you can, after you post, once you get the comments rolling, like there's so many stress points, I guess, that you can do in social media. Makes it difficult.
It's a whole new thing
that we got to deal with here. So, okay, we've talked about some of the bad stuff, you know, like the ways that social media can really, you know, harm us, right? You know, you want to, of course, you know, be aware if basically how social media, I guess, makes you feel when you're using it, right? You want to be aware of if there's change in your life or if you're withdrawing from people because of social media. And really, I guess, remember that it's a, you know, digital life is not real life in many ways. What you're seeing is a highlight reel in a lot of cases. But what were you about to say?
I was going to say, I no longer separate real life and digital life.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of my colleagues in internet research who've kind of moved that direction because it's so difficult to disentangle how your digital life is connected to your face-to-face life or your physical life.
Right.
The fact that people's devices are on them, the fact that you're wearing Fitbits that's tracking your steps, the fact that your phone that's in your pocket is also tracking your steps and your possibly when you're sleeping and your heart rate and all that stuff. And for people who check it, that becomes another way in which kind of your digital life is your physical life is being monitored by technologies. Mm-hmm. And that is informing all this other stuff that may be coming your way in a form of advertisements and, you know, emails, even though you might not even be aware of it. And the other thing is just that if you think about how often you pick up your phone, so I will put this out to you and all your listeners. Observe yourself for 24 hours, just one day, any day of the week, and take notes. How many times do you pick up your phone throughout the day? How many times do you, what do you use your devices for? Do you use them for emailing for work? Do you use them to text your loved ones? Are you on WhatsApp? Are you on social media? What are you using it for? Are you on your Fitbit? Are you on your bank app? And look at your screen time. Check out what your screen time is on your phone. You can look at the daily average, the weekly average, and the monthly average usually, and kind of get a sense of what you're using it for. And I think one of the things you start finding is that our digital life is so embedded in our day-to-day life now that, but we don't think of it that way. I think about how many times I've texted friends to chat with them today. I wasn't thinking of that as digital life, but I am negotiating those relationships and those friendships through text messages and emails and Zoom, right? And we're sitting here right now on a Zoom-like kind of, called a Zoom-like, right? It's another platform.
They're all Zoom-like now. Zoom is the word.
But that's my other point, right? Like the fact that you see, but does this feel real to you? Do you feel like we're not in, this isn't real life?
Right. No, it feels like we're in the same room.
Yeah.
It feels like we're been having a conversation, chatting, you know, like we would have done at a coffee shop long ago.
And unlike the telephone, the one thing we have about all these, the Zoom kind of, you know, the video chat options now is we do also get the visual cues, which people's big complaint is that the big complaint for a long time about different kinds of social media and technologies for communication was that, you miss the social cues, you miss seeing their expressions. And now we can't say that when we're using video chat. The one thing we can say is, we can't smell them. We can't touch them. Right. We can't kiss them. But people have been having phone sex and sexting on video chat, which again, it's not, you don't get the tactile experience of, you know, hand to hand or body to body, but it's closer. So with that, I bring up as real life and digital life get far more merged. The trends and the movements for virtual reality and augmented reality.
Oh, right. Look at Facebook becoming Meta, and so that they can kind of create this whole, oops, I just hit my mic. So that they could create this whole metaverse, of like this virtual world. By the way, I did look up how many times I picked up my phone. Now, I didn't want to look at today's because, it's a work day and who knows, right? So I looked at yesterday just to be fair and to see how many times I picked it up. 199.
There you go.
That is insane.
So, would you now say that your technologies are not embedded in your daily life?
Right. Jeez, that is crazy. Now today, 132. It's a work day today, so I guess I picked it up a little less. I thought that would be the opposite.
And then where do you pick it up? Are you like in bed? Are you just walking down the street listening to the radio? Are you in the bathroom? I mean, people use their phones everywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But I mean, you think about the virtual reality and the augmented reality, right? So Google Glasses have been out for years. Google's been trying to also jump on that. But one of the things, if you think about, just to kind of make this a very sexy topic for a moment, if it wasn't already, how did the internet expand? A lot of it was military complex, right? Military was paying, used ARPANET and kind of started that. Those first bulletin boards, right? So, government funding was a huge part of what built a lot of the infrastructure of the internet, but so did the porn industry.
Yeah.
The desire to make, to be able to have images, right? To have images move and then have moving images, right? To have video.
Right.
Porn and the military have been a big part of this kind of movement.
Totally.
And I would throw out the same thing if we think about the pandemic in just a different way. What was one of the biggest complaints people had about lockdown for people who were not partnered, or multi-partnered, whichever, people who didn't have the ability to have intimate relationships? One of the things was, I don't get to touch anybody. I don't have sexual activity. And one of the questions about online dating that was coming up are more people sexting, and a lot of the dating apps started adding the video chat option. I mean, Bumble already had it before pandemic started, but all of a sudden they were advertising it because people were getting more comfortable being on their computer screens to chat. And I definitely had people in my survey that said, I couldn't see the person I was seeing. They lived over there and I lived here and we were locked down. And so, I had people talk about their first time ever having kind of a video sex kind of experience. And so you can imagine that companies that are working on virtual reality and augmented reality are thinking that was probably one of the, and how do we move this so that we can feel touch, right? Like that's the next dimension I think we would see. And so when you say talk about a grand experiment, I'll be so curious to see before I die if we will stop hearing that, technology is just not as good as face-to-face because we can't have this part. I really wonder which part is next. And I don't know. I don't know which it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. The military and the porn industry. So was it Bill Gates? I mean, I'm sorry. Was it Al Gore or was it Bill Clinton? I guess that... Never mind. See, I'm nervous about that joke now.
It was just a cigar. I know. I'm like, which part of that? You know, right? That was a political and a sexual joke.
Exactly. All in one.
I'm going to cancel you, Russ. How dare you?
Oh, cigar? No.
Never cancel. That should be a new hashtag.
Exactly. Right. Please don't cancel me. All right, Ricky. So you actually, since the last time we talked, and like I mentioned, we had a fantastic talk about, the pandemic dating, online dating. And it just because it has the topic of pandemic dating doesn't mean that show should not be listened to kind of outside of lockdown. Cause I learned so much from that. And every time I hear about a picture with a big fish, I laugh.
We did talk about like just the norms of dating, but just how I think the pandemic complicated it. And I think I'm going to go back and listen to it because I'm continuing to collect data. We're not out of this yet, you know?
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see as we continue to deal with numbers rising and, you know, what we're a year and a half into this. And I just heard we're in the fifth surge, you know, in Europe right now. And so I think this will definitely be, yes, we should go back and listen to that at some point, because I think we will continue to learn about how we connect with technology and our mental health around social media, right? Like it's all connected.
It totally is. Totally is. So I'll put a link to that episode. I also want to put a link to your website. You just redid your website as well.
Yeah, it's rickithompson.com. RIKITHOMPSON. Okay.
We'll put a link to that in the description as well. Ricky, it's always fabulous to talk to you. And I hope maybe we'll do an update on the online thing or we'll talk about something else. I got to figure out a way to get you back. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Russ. Always a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you about something very fascinating and interesting down the road again.
No, I can't wait. Thank you for listening and subscribing to Learning More. We encourage you. And thank you for rating this podcast and sharing it with your friends. As with any podcast that gives medical or legal opinion, the information is not meant to substitute professional advice. And we encourage you to consult a professional to discuss your exact needs. I invite you to check out our daily podcast. I've already talked about it a couple times on this one. It's called This Is Today, where you will learn the history of each day and the story of each day, including national events, daily history, and some fun stories. This Is Today is available wherever you get your podcasts, and there's a link in the description. Okay, next time on Learning More, we are going to learn about perfectionism. Should the word perfect just go away? Let's talk about that next time on Learning More. If you have something that you would like to learn more about, let us know, and it may just become one of our future episodes. Submit your ideas and comments at learningmorepodcast.com. Again, thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. I'm Russ, and I look forward to learning more with you next time.